name is Ari Alanis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and you are listening to Multifaithful, a podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. In this week's podcast, I'm joined by Reverend Jennifer Bailey, one of the most prominent multifaith leaders in the United States and someone who has done incredible work in the multifaith movement for justice and was recently named one of the 15 faith leaders to watch in the United States by the Center for American Progress. We have an amazing conversation about racial justice in the United States and where our movement can go from here. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now to this week's conversation. I am joined today by Reverend Jennifer Bailey, founder of the Faith Matters Network, as well as one of the Center for American Progress 15 Faith Leaders to Watch from 2015. Thank you for joining us, Reverend Bailey.
So happy to be with you all. Thanks for having me.
And I'm joined by a first-time student on the podcast, one of our absolute favorites. Anthony, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Anthony Suggs. I am a senior at NYU studying history and drama. My history work focuses mainly on religious history and post-colonial societies. So my thesis was on the educational policies of the Southern Baptist Church in Reconstruction South.
So, Reverend Bailey, I know that you started the Faith Matters Network and are very involved in interfaith and also in justice work. And I think that this work has been particularly relevant in maybe the last couple of years as issues of race in our country have, I think they've always been an issue, but have become more and more part of the public discourse. So I'm curious, how has your work, what types of things have you been doing on this front? What type of work have you been doing to give people maybe an introduction into some of the interfaith work in this field that's going on?
That's a great question, and thanks so much for asking me. So when I think about what got me involved in interfaith work in the first place, I was a freshman in high school in 2001 when 9/11 happened, my second week of high school in Chicago, Illinois. And I know that for me, one of the things that was particularly striking was the images that I saw coming through my television sets. Initially, both from the World Trade Center, and then the images of these people, these foreign people overseas, of men and women and children that we were preparing to call our enemies. And what struck me during that particular moment is that their skin was brown like mine, and I began to think about what else I might have in common with these other folks. And as a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is the oldest historically black denomination in the United States, the question of race and ethnicity and justice has always been central to how I understand my faith and how I understand who God is in the world. There's a saying in the black church that our Bible starts in Exodus with a narrative of liberation rather than Genesis. And so everything that we read in the black church tradition is through that lens of justice and liberation. And I think over the past year, especially in August 2014 with the slaying of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, you know, I think a renewed interest and light was shed on the state of American race relations. And that question is inherently an interfaith question. When we say that Black Lives Matter, for example, we're not just talking about black Christian lives, although the majority of African Americans in the United States are Christian, but we're also talking about black Muslim lives, black Jewish lives. And I think that's one of the many things that's overlooked in this question of what we mean when we talk about racial justice. And for me, and part of this is just my own positionality and identity as an African American woman who's been involved in interfaith work since I was in high school, that intersection feels like one of the key questions moving forward. If the interfaith movement is to be relevant in the 21st century, and if we are to address the very issues and challenges that are at the heart of what I would call the great American question, right? Which is whether or not people of all different backgrounds really do have equity and access to what we would call the American dream. I think many people would call it the myth of the American dream, but I would call it the aspiration of the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. America's always been an aspiration. We haven't ever fully lived into the promise of who we can be in the world. We have to start by thinking about and really addressing one of the greatest original sins in this country, which is the question of racism and institutional racism.
So you feel, I want to tie this in a little bit more to your Faith Matters Network work. How do you feel your organization, which focuses primarily on digital storytelling, can change the way activism deals with these issues of race and racism in America?
So stories is how we communicate with one another, right? Stories are the way that we, particularly as people of faith, understand ourselves and our traditions. And over the past decade or so, we've seen storytelling become a key tool and skill that activists and organizers are using to create both counter-narratives and new narratives about existing challenges in our country, whether that's around the criminal justice system or broader challenges like food justice, which is the movement that my activism and organizing comes out of. And so most recently, a campaign that we've partnered with at the Faith Matters Network is called Stand with Black Women and Girls. It is a faith-filled advocacy campaign that combines liturgical resources, including interfaith resources, along with digital storytelling tools and advocacy resources to engage people in an online but also in-person dialogue around the unique challenges facing Black women and girls in the United States. And one of the many reasons why we signed on to the campaign is that, particularly over the last year, as, again, racial justice has become front and center with the deaths of Mike Brown and Freddie Gray, the Charleston Nine in Charleston, South Carolina. One of the trends that we saw, and this is one of the ongoing challenges when we talk about doing intersectional organizing and activism, is that the stories of Black women who'd also faced, you know, police brutality and other oppressive circumstances and encounters with not just the criminal justice system, but ongoing disproportionate impacts of things like the school-to-prison pipeline and suspension rates. Those women were not being recognized. Women and girls often are rendered invisible in those conversations as we uplift male examples. And so one of the reasons why we wanted to sign on with the Stand with Black Women and Girls campaign was to elevate those stories and to get additional and renewed energy focused on that particular area with that particular population. For that project, we've had people like the PICO National Network that we're partnering with on that, the Black Church Center for Justice and Equality, which is based out of Maryland, and a number of local congregations who've signed on to support that initiative. And it is an initiative that is primarily coordinated online, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the trends, right, of 21st century organizing, is that I think when we talk about the history of social movements in the United States, they've always adapted to the technology that has been available to them, whether that's radio in the 1920s and 30s, television with the American Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s and 60s. And today, when we think about something like Black Lives Matter, right, it's the internet, it's social media that's allowing news and issues to be elevated in a way that they wouldn't otherwise. And so it's a really exciting campaign, and I would invite people to check it out. Stand with BWG on Twitter and Facebook is the hashtag, and would love to share more about that if we have time.
Yeah, and so I'm curious. I want to tie together a few of the things you were talking about, because in an earlier episode of the podcast, we talked to Valerie Kaur, who's also done a lot of amazing work using digital media online to build an interfaith movement. And so I'm curious that in the wake of one of the ways that the interfaith movement shows up, I think in great ways, are in the wake of tragedies, interfaith coalitions coming together, or interfaith, sometimes like the interfaith press conference, but faith leaders coming together to say like, this is wrong to all of us, and really showing that support. And I know that you're a member of the AME Church, right?
Yes, I am.
So I actually had friends in rabbinical school who went down to South Carolina after the shooting in the church and felt it was like important to go. And I'm also aware that sometimes there's a criticism of kind of this showing up, and then when it dissipates, there's not much left. So I'm curious if maybe you could give us some guidance. Like, how do we do that showing up well? And how do we maybe not, and what are some instances where we haven't done that showing up well? And how do we, you know, as we think about being allies in interfaith contexts, how do we approach that?
Sure. You know, that Thursday morning in June when I heard about the shooting at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, my heart stopped. The AME Church, which is my denomination, the denomination I grew up in, and the denomination that I am ordained in, is, you know, again, the oldest historically Black denomination in the U.S., and Mother mm-hmm. Emanuel is one of our flagship congregations, which has a long history of, just like our denomination does, of, you know, resistance against racial injustice.
Yeah.
It was the site of a planned slave revolt, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think part of showing up and showing up well is understanding the historical context for such actions. So it's not rare, nor has it been rare historically, that African-American places of worship have been attacked and terrorized in the South, right? It's not rare that in the history, in the long history of the African-American struggle for civil rights and justice in this country, that that brutal physical violence has been used as a means to stymie that progress. And so for me, Mother Emanuel and the shooting there and the souls that were lost that day, it's not just a hypothetical, you know?
Yeah.
I called my pastor in Nashville that morning, and he was shell-shocked because he had previously been in South Carolina as a pastor and knew Reverend Clementa Pinckney, who was killed there, very well. And one of the things that I think national tragedies, like the shooting at Mother Emanuel, really opens up is a space for what Valerie Carr and a couple of other people, Reverend Jackie Lewis at Middle Collegiate Church in New York, have begun to call prophetic grief,
mm-hmm.
which is a leaning into and really feeling, right, ourselves as a part of the communities that are suffering and that we are indicted. And the way that manifests for me most directly is that, you know, as a Christian, Dylann Roof was raised in somebody's church and confirmed in somebody's church.
Right.
And what was he not taught that in that church that led him to do what he did? You know, I think it's going to be an ongoing challenge. The work of movement building is messy work. And particularly when we begin to interrogate the question of race, we have to begin to interrogate the question of power and privilege. And I've done some work with Showing Up for Racial Justice, which is a national organization of white folks organizing other white folks around racial justice, mm-hmm. which is beginning to really interrogate what it is about white culture as it's been constructed in the United States. I'm very careful about naming it as constructed white culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
That prevents not only a deep empathy for people who are suffering, and particularly people of color that are suffering, but a real resistance to it. And the reality is, you know, that there are certain people who benefit from the very systems that are oppressing and marginalizing others. By and large, those are people who self-identify as white.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine, like, I've never been a white person, so I can't say, right? That it would be really unnerving to begin pushing back against the very systems that are meant to protect you, whether that's the criminal justice system or, you know, in some ways our economic system, right?
Right.
And labor practices. And so my challenge always for folks, and I've been doing a lot of speaking over the last year with interfaith groups, with faith communities of faiths that are different than my own. And my challenge continually has been to ask people to lean into that sense of prophetic grief, to really feel, right?
Yeah.
And the depths of their spirits and souls, what's going on. And then begin to look internally at their own, whether it be a congregational context or organizational context, and interrogate the question of, you know, if it's a white congregation, why there aren't people of color there, right? And examining and thinking about the very ways in which we all carry implicit and explicit biases. And I name that internal work as being crucial to understanding the kind of broader picture of racial justice, in part because I've been parts of organizations and groups that are, you know, geared towards racial reconciliation, right, with the best of intent, that have yet to do kind of the deep work that allows for a truly equitable conversation around race, which means centering the voices of communities of color. And for some folks, that's really hard, right? Mm-hmm. Especially folks who aren't used to being at the center of the conversation. And so, you know, I would invite people, especially white folks who are interested in racial justice work, to check out Showing Up for Racial Justice's website. They call themselves Surge. They do some really great work, and they just launched a new division of Surge called Surge Faith that is specifically looking at the way white faith communities can really show up in a real and true authentic way for racial justice nationally.
So it seems like a really large and important piece of this picture is quality education in the history of racial justice in America. You know, people who write history wield so much power to shape the way we view the issues that we face in our daily lives. So, in your experience and in your expertise, how have you found ways to use history and education to speak to people when you're not, quote unquote, preaching to the choir? How do you use education and the truth when you're speaking to people who are adamantly against or just ill-equipped to understand the issues that you're talking about?
So I think a big part of history, right, is storytelling, right? Histories and the ways that different histories are told are narratives, they're stories. And by and large, the people who communicate and who write down our histories are people historically have been from dominant communities and communities in power. And so I think part of the work that Faith Matters is really committed to through our narrative-based storytelling work is capturing those histories that may have gone untold. So it's going to places like Selma, Alabama, or Bayou La Batre, Alabama, and capturing the stories of the civil rights movements there, and the civil rights movements that are still happening today. You know, along the Gulf Coast of Alabama and Mississippi, people are still reeling from the BP oil spill, mm-hmm. including, you know, Vietnamese fisherfolk who are Christian and Buddhist, organizing to really get their livelihoods back, organizing around environmental and economic justice. And so I think that there's a two-part answer to your question. One is capturing the histories that have historically been left out or marginalized. You know, the history of women's roles in these movements, the histories of LGBT folks' role in these movements, and recording them and through creative means. That's one of the greatest things we have access to today, is an unlimited means of resources to capture these stories and to produce these stories in creative and interesting ways that capture people's imagination and broaden people's understandings of our history. And I think there's a second part to this, which is figuring out ways to share existing information that is available, right? So we have the information in histories that haven't been recorded, and we have the histories that are present, and finding creative ways to, again, get that out there, whether it be through the development of exciting curricula. So I know for myself, I was a big social studies history nerd in high school, mm-hmm. and elementary school and college.
Me too.
And loved that. There are a lot of people who aren't, right? Like, for fun, I like reading about, you know, the civil rights movement or 19th century abolitionist movement. Most people aren't like me, right? And so that's why, when it's very fun in innovative ways and creative ways, I mean, I think we have to engage things like arts and culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to engage the digital world. We have to engage other tools, music, to tell the stories of these movements and to tell our histories. Because that's the way people learn. And I don't, I'm a millennial, right? And so I have an attention span of a gnat, and that's part of partly a result of being so plugged in for most of my adolescent and adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think those creative ways serve as an entry point for people, an entry point to access for those particular histories. And from there, that's how we hook people to help them dive more deeply into those deeper historical narratives.
So it's interesting that you're bringing up history, because I feel like issues of racial justice, especially in the United States, are so closely tied to religion. I mean, when people think of leaders in kind of this field, they think of Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, people who are very clearly taking from religious backgrounds. And today it feels like the movement is a little bit different. I don't know if there's that singular religious figure, and even some of the most well-known figures like Ta-Nehisi Coates are atheist or are not interested in having their religious identity speak to this. So I'm curious how much of a, I'm not even sure what my question really is, but I'm curious if you could maybe unpack that for us a little bit, or just talk about in the broader movement, what is it, you know, is there like a religion part and a non-religion part, or how is that kind of playing itself out?
You know, I think one of the things that's interesting about contemporary civil rights movements and struggles, particularly over the last 5 or so years, is that it's a different model of leadership, right? So there may not be the single charismatic leader. Ella Baker, who was one of the co-founders of SNCC and a longtime movement activist during the civil rights movement, really did a lot of the architecture and behind-the-scenes work, training up leaders, so that we should have leaderful movements, right?
Mm-hmm.
That strong people don't need strong leaders. And I think when you see the contemporary iterations of these movements, they really come from that school and that philosophy, that there are a number of different people who step up and can be present and can be leaders and who are already leaders, who already have voices. That's really a shift. I think, you know, the question of faith is an interesting one in these movements. One of the things that Black Lives Matter, I know, and that, or the movement for Black Lives, as they're becoming known as a national coalition, really centers the health and wholeness and spiritual mm-hmm. wellness of each of its members, right? And for some folks, that might come through a Christian gaze, right? Or a Muslim gaze, or a Jewish gaze, or a Buddhist gaze.
Right.
But for some folks, that spirituality may not take the same form and may not be attached to organized religion in the same way that it was in the past. And I think part of that is generational, right? I think especially, you know, young adults are increasingly identifying as spiritual and not religious.
Yes.
I think part of that also is tied to the centrality of queer voices in these movements and queer voices of faith, but also queer voices that really have push back against some of the heterosexism within religious institutions that tend to perpetuate mm-hmm. and occupy space in a really harmful way. And so I think what you're seeing in movements is new ways of really attending to not only self-care, but communal self-care and healing and wholeness. Personally, you know, knowing my history, I know there have always been folks who have identified as atheist or agnostic, right? Deeply entrenched in these movements. And so I think it would be foolish of faith communities to dismiss the contributions of those groups.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that, in particular, you know, I am a Black Christian preacher, right?
Right.
I preach in the Black church. But I've felt myself really challenged in positive ways by Black atheism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by Ta-Nehisi Coates and other writers who have really pushed my understanding of what it means to be active in this movement now, right?
Right.
Part of my faith narrative is that there is a resurrection day, right? There is the end of the day in the midst of sorrow and tragedy, that there is some hope for a better future attached to it. What happens if you don't have that analysis? I think it calls us into a different and more direct and immediate form of presence that has been, you know, a really beautiful push for my own kind of faith understanding of this work.
Right. Right. And it's always, I've always found it striking as someone who's religious myself. I've always found the religious narratives to be, very powerful to me. But I have read, you know, recently, especially from Ta-Nehisi Coates, about kind of rejecting that redemption narrative and needing to just push it yourself. And that there is, you know, and the way you said it, being like pushed and challenged, I think is particularly poignant to me, because that's I think a feeling I've had also reading some of that. I found it to be really helpful for my own thinking.
And I think a tension that exists there, right, is that for religious folks to not dismiss those who may not hold the same faith beliefs as them, and for the non-religious folks to not dismiss, you know, the many grandmothers, aunties, and uncles who are deeply rooted in their faith, who were the foot soldiers of the movement that made, you know, the civil rights movement work and continue to be the lifeblood of our community. So, you know, dialogue in a really healthy way. We can learn a lot from one another, and I just wish that people would embrace that sense of dialogue and curiosity with a more open heart. And increasingly, I've seen those dialogues happen specifically in the Black church, which is like, that's a big deal for the Black church and having those types of dialogues. But, you know, my hope and my prayer is that we can continue to learn from one another in really healthy and helpful ways.
Well, given that you're the preacher and not me, and you just gave us a nice prayer, I think that is the best note we can come with to end on. So thank you, Reverend Bailey, for joining us. Thank you to Anthony.
Thank you.
I definitely learned a lot, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you all so much.
All right. Hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Bye.
Yeah. Thank you.
Listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Especially like to thank our guest, Reverend Jennifer Bailey, for such an amazing conversation. Thank you also to Anthony for joining us on the podcast for the first time and for us just having a blast before and after the podcast hanging out. Always great to have you in the office, Anthony. Special thank you to Liz Suatos, whose music is from the Of Many Film, and to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast all the way from Ghana. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes, and we look forward to having you back for another episode.